Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul. BlakeRadio.com.
Welcome to another episode of Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul. I am your host, Deirdre Schuler, and on today's show, we're going to talk about books. The writing of books, the publishing of books, the distribution of books, and the reading of books, and what that all entails. Writers must spend a lot of time inside their head, but they also have to be good observers. The best books are books that are close to the life experience of an author. And although it may be fiction, one has the opportunity to embellish, and one can certainly create out of their imagination, and many people do. But writing requires experiences and the ability to tap deep into one's own emotions as well as into the emotions of those around us. My guest today is author Bernice L. McFadden, who has written at least 14 books. Seven or eight of those she has written under her real name, which is Bernice L. McFadden, and she's written at least five under the name Geneva Holiday. And several of Ms. McFadden's books have been critically acclaimed, two of which I've read, and that was Sugar and Glorious. And each of those went on to be, well, tagged classics. And all I know is that after finishing one of McFadden's books, I was looking around to see if I could find another. In my case, it will probably be The Bitter Earth, because I think that's a follow-up to Sugar. A New Yorker, Ms. McFadden has placed some of her characters in the Deep South, as well as some of her characters in the Renaissance period in New York. A finalist for the NAACP Image Award, and a two-time finalist for the Hurston Wright Legacy Award, one of Ms. McFadden's books was featured in Oprah Winfrey's magazine, Oh. And Ms. McFadden wasn't always an author. Like the rest of us, she worked in the corporate world, applying her hand to retail and travel while trying to find that job, well, that job that held her interest. But finally, she found her niche in the world of literature, and I'm happy to say she's been there ever since. I believe her latest book is on the horizon, and that is entitled Gathering of Waters. So maybe Bernice will give us a glimpse into that upcoming novel when she comes on. She's not even here yet, and I hope she will be here soon.
You know, at the top of the show, I forgot to mention that the first song that I played was Mood Indigo, and that was with Duke Ellington on the piano, and Louis Armstrong singing, as well as playing the trumpet. And now, I think we're going to listen to a little bit of Billie while we're waiting, Billie Holiday, and she's going to sing St. Louis Blues. So here we go. St. Louis Blues, Billie Holiday. Hey.
there already. I hung up and called back.
Oh, I see.
I heard your whole introduction.
Oh, cool. So I'm glad that you called back, and we'll go right into the show then. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Okay. I'm doing well. So as you continue to write, has it become easier and easier to come up with the characters in your book? I know, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I wouldn't really put it that way. I don't sit down and come up with the characters. Writing for me has always been, and I hope it will continue to be, a very spiritual process. So the characters actually come to me. And sometimes it can start with a phrase that is repeated in my head over and over and over again until I give in, and then just start writing down what I first start hearing and then start seeing, and the character is developed from that point on.
You're saying that they just sort of pop into your imagination, or you
mm-hmm.
actually visualize them?
Yes, I see them. It's almost like dreaming when you're wide awake.
Oh, okay. Do you have an idea what you're going to write about, or that also comes in time?
That also comes. I mean, with Sugar, my first book, I had this woman who had been with me for quite some time in my head, and first I wrote a poem. I wrote a poem for her. And she just stayed with me over the years, and finally I sat down and started writing this entire story that surrounded her. So that's how it works with all of my stories. I may sit here today and say, oh, I'd like to write about X, Y, and Z, and it may never happen, but the good thing is something from that story that I have in my head may spin off into another story.
And that's exactly what is going to happen with, it did happen, I should say. I haven't read the book yet, but that's going to be my next book, is The Bitter Earth, because that's the spinoff from Sugar.
Yes, This Bitter Earth. Mm-hmm.
This Bitter Earth. Oh, okay. And I won't ask and spoil it for myself what will happen, but I hope it's going to be a good ending.
It's a satisfying ending, I think.
Oh, good. You know, you tend to fall in love with your characters, and you want them to end up well.
Right, right. I understand that.
But they don't always.
No, they
don't.
And,
you know, I just finished with Glorious.
Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy it?
I did.
Oh, wonderful.
There seemed to be a pause there. Just as you thought she was going to hit the big time, jumped ahead.
Yes. Yes, I have a habit of doing that.
Oh, okay. So I've only read two of your books, but, you know, they whet my appetite, should I say.
And oh, wonderful.
I shall be, as I say, This Bitter Earth will be next.
Thank you. I appreciate
that.
I've got
to find out what happened to Sugar. So, tell me, what... You sort of just did tell me what your writing process is, but I have a friend, well, several friends that are writers, and one or two of them, they have notes taped all over their computers and logs and ideas of stuff that they're going to incorporate in their book. Is that what you do?
No. I don't outline. I write out of chronological order. I very rarely write a linear story. Whatever character comes to me on whatever day or whatever month, that's the character that I work on, and that's the story that I tell. At the end, when I've reached the end of the book, I sit down, and it's much like one puts together a puzzle, and I have to piece it together to make sense. So that's how it works for me.
Do your characters suddenly almost become your children or your friends? They're with you. How long does it take to write a book? I mean, I'm sure it's different times.
Well, you know, I can say from the time I start to actually put it down on paper, it could take about a year. But the story is with me for at least three. I start thinking about it. I start, you know, putting together the scenes in my head and just receiving all this information. I may be working on another story while a new story is brewing. So I would say all in all, with the pondering and the writing, it's probably 2 to 3 years.
Ah. That's a while, because you just released Glorious not that long ago, and already Gathering, is it called Gathering of the Waters is coming?
Gathering of Waters, yes.
Gathering of Waters.
Glorious was published in May of 2010, but I had been working on that story from 2005. I had started working on that story in 2005. So
Glorious or Gathering of Waters?
Glorious. Sorry, oh. Glorious. I started working on that story in 2005. I was completely finished with it in probably 2007, and I was trying to find a house to publish it. So it took me about 2 years to find a house that would publish it.
Now, you've been published by different publishers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. And people think that once you get a publisher, they'll keep publishing you, but apparently that's not the way it works, correct?
No, that's not the case, because it all comes down to the numbers. If you stop selling what they expect you to sell, then the publishers, you know, they discontinue your contract, and you have to move on.
Well, speaking of that, I wanted to address an issue with you. I read an article that you wrote about Catherine Stockett.
Uh huh.
The woman.
Well, it was about
publishing. Well, not
but
about
I used Catherine Stockett. Yes.
As an example of
yes.
of what your premise was.
Uh huh.
And your premise was, well, let me just tell people who she is. She's the lady that wrote The Help.
Mm-hmm.
The popular book that I guess has been on the bestseller list for 14 weeks now, and a movie's
being made. No, not 14 weeks. It's been on the bestsellers list for almost 2 years.
That long?
Yeah, it's been on the bestsellers list for about maybe a year and a half.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess I read an old article.
Mm-hmm.
And someone that was talking about... they didn't think that she was such a great writer, and already her book was out. But that was an Hispanic woman who was saying that. And my point is that your point was is that, you know, a white writer primarily can write about black people, but you don't find that, and they'll get published, but you don't find that in the reverse. And maybe the lucky few like Walter Mosley might make a movie on his first book, because that was her first book.
Yes, The Help was Catherine Stockett's first book. But my point in my article was that she had written a story that had I written it or any one of my contemporaries had written it, it would have been marketed as a black book and certainly would not have gained... the attention, the celebrity, and the movie deal that it's received. Because here we have a white woman telling what publishing would normally consider a black story, and quote-unquote black story, then it's okay. So, in fact, Catherine is published by the same publishing house that published the first six books I wrote. And never, not for any of those six books, did I receive the marketing and publicity support that she received. And the other point was that this book was crossed over, so white people, it's really the white people who put it on the map. They were the first people to get a hold of this book. And after it did well, from this is just from my research, then the publisher started reaching out into the black community, because when the book first came out, and I was still, you know, meeting with book clubs, African-American book clubs, and I would mention it, they were unaware of the book. It's not until about 6 to 8 months after the book had been on the Times for some time that African-Americans really started to become aware of the book, and they supported the book. A lot of folk, even though her photo is on the back of the book, in the beginning they didn't know that she was a white woman.
Mm-hmm. And a rich one at that, they say.
I'm sorry?
They say she's a wealthy woman in her own right.
Oh, is she? Okay, I had no idea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my issue has never been with Catherine, because I'm assuming she wrote the book that was in her heart and in her soul, like most of us do. I would like to think it was not a calculated thing that she did. She claims to have had 60 rejection letters. I don't know if that's true or not, but my issue is with the machine behind the book. And this book has been written. It's been written a number of times by African Americans. But I suppose that, I'm sorry?
I agree. There's plenty of African American books writing about a similar subject.
Yes, but I suppose that, you know, in order for them to effectively cross a book over in their minds, it has to be, the reality of the subject matter needs to be sanitized, glossed over, and when white people write about black culture, they tend to do that, which makes it acceptable for the white population, because you don't have the really horrible things shoved into their faces or down their throats, however you want to put it. So I
but
get
in this
it.
Book, she makes white women look like silly gadabouts.
She makes them look like, I'm sorry?
Like they're silly gadabouts, that they're prejudiced and racist. And
well, yeah, no, and that's acceptable, but the thing is that here she's writing about, you know, these black maids and how these black maids deal with their white employers. Now, let me also say, because, you know, I knew what the subject matter was, because I knew about the machine behind the book, I have not read the book. I know the premise of the book. I've discussed it with a number of people. At some point, I will read the book when, you know, I'm in a different space. But from, you know, my conversations with a number of educated black women, you know, they're very offended by the subject matter. And essentially, from what I understand, is exactly what Skeeter, who's the protagonist in the book, did to the maid is what Catherine Stockett, the writer, is doing to the black literary community. So, you know, Skeeter, she went off to New York, and she becomes a famous writer, and the maid that she gained all, or gleaned all this knowledge from, and then, you know, wrote this book and scandalized the town, she loses her job. So
well, they're all left in danger because they're left to face the rage of the community.
Of the community. So here Catherine Stockett has appropriated a culture and benefited from it. And where does that leave us, the black writers?
She kind of tries to address that in the book, but the girl still goes.
Right. So, you know, what I'd like to ask Catherine, if I could have a conversation with her, is, you know, you have all this celebrity, you have all this power at the moment. You did appropriate black culture, and that's fine. You can do what you want to do. But now, how then are you going to help black writers? Are you going to pull one, two, or three of them to come along with you when you go and speak to your audience to introduce these unknown black writers to your audience? Because obviously, in my head, this was your influence.
I'm sure she hasn't even thought that. That has probably not even come to her mind.
Because this is what happened. I mean, even if you look at, you know, the Rolling Stones, they tried to include on their mega tours black artists, because these black artists were their influence. You have to pay homage to your influence. You know, that's how you continue to go forward. That's how you remain blessed in my world.
Yes. And even the Beatles did that.
Exactly. So, you know, she needs to take a page from that book. That's just my opinion. I'm sure plenty of folk will disagree with that, but that's just how I feel.
Well, maybe she'll listen to this show and get the idea, because it probably doesn't occur to her on her own. I could be wrong, but I doubt it. Now, I would like to know something about your background. And by the way, folks, we're talking to Bernice L. McFadden, an authoress that has written, oh, how many books have you written now? 14?
Wait a minute, let's see. It's 12. 13.
Combined.
13,
right?
When Gathering of Waters is published, it'll be 13.
Okay, almost got it. But you also write under Geneva Holiday?
Yes, and so that's the combination of the two. I've written 5 books as Geneva Holiday.
Now, it seems Geneva Holiday, she just likes to get out there and have a little fun and be exotic and a little sexy. And
yeah, that's a completely different part of the brain working. It's a completely different process. It's like going on vacation. My subject matter as Bernice McFadden is usually very heavy, and Geneva Holiday was just very light and humorous and sexy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it was a good time.
I got the sense of Stella Got a Groove Back kind of thing.
Well, yeah.
Kind of light.
I guess you could put it in that category.
But is that fun for you after having, you know, because the other books, they're very, historical in some ways.
Yes.
But, I mean, glorious. The opening chapter, I don't want to give it away, but I just will mention a lynching that was horrific.
Yeah. That's more, yeah, that's early on in the book. I now say that, you know, writing has always been a part of me, but I've always been very interested in history. And what I found with each book I published was that I would inject a little bit more of history into it, and, you know, certain degrees of history. And Glorious is actually my first full-fledged historical novel. And so now I say that I'm actually a historian masquerading as a novelist.
Well, you certainly brought in the Harlem Renaissance in there with Langston Hughes, because your character ends up being a writer.
Yes. And Easter, who's the protagonist of the book, she's actually a combination of Zora Neale Hurston and Nella Larsen, because as fond as I am of their works, I was more interested in their lives. And that's really kind of how this story came to be.
Yes, the parties that you mentioned are quite interesting. You know, I've read in other books there were always these great parties that they did during the Renaissance era, where there was the hobnobbing of the white and the black.
Yep, the black and white parties.
It's basically
the black and beige, however, the tan and
successful.
Yeah, that's all very interesting to me.
Yes. Now, tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a Brooklynite?
I am, born and bred, and I still live here in Brooklyn. I've lived in 3 neighborhoods. I grew up in Crown Heights. At the age of 18, my family moved to East New York. We bought a home out there. And then as a grown woman, I bought my own home here in Bedford-Stuyvesant, historical Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Wow, so cool. Mm-hmm. And Brooklyn is really changing. As you know, a lot of people don't want to go to Brooklyn, but it's become the Mecca.
It is the Mecca, and yeah, a lot of people are coming to Brooklyn. It's cheaper to live here. We're right across the bridge. If you're in this area, I mean, you know, Clinton Hill, Fort Greene, Bed-Stuy.
I know that area.
Yeah, right over the bridge. Right over the bridge. Beautiful homes, great people. The neighborhood that I'm living in, you know, for a minute in the 70s and 80s into the mid-90s, it was kind of forgotten, I think. You know, it went through a rough time with the crack epidemic. And I moved here in 2001, and it was starting to turn around. About 1999, you know, the yuppies and the buppies were coming in buying the brownstones, and slowly but surely it started to turn around. And at one point there was no bookstore, no coffee shop, no restaurants except, you know, Chinese restaurants or, you know, fried chicken places and fast food spots. And now we have, you know, wine bar, we have wine store, coffee shop. It's just, you know, it's like living in the village.
And a lot of culture, a lot of
culture.
Entertainment people have formed communities there.
Oh, yes, and it's a big writing mecca. There are a lot of writers who live here in Brooklyn.
So I hear.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'm up in the Bronx. Who can afford to live in Manhattan these days?
Exactly.
Now, did you ever consider or did you think of writing when you were a youngster, or did you write as a youngster?
I did. I've been writing like little stories since I was about, I would say, 8. I started reading very early. My mother taught me to read very early, and that was an escape for me because I was a very shy child. And I would rather just stay in my bedroom and read my books than go outside and play. And so I told myself very, very early on that I would be a writer. Obviously, as I got older, I became a teenager and just kind of looked around and realized there weren't any writers out there who looked like me, meaning black and female, and those who did were dead. Because that's what we were reading in school. And I went away.
So
there
was a paucity of information about black people when I went to school.
Right. I went to an all-white boarding high school. So you can imagine what we were reading. Mm-hmm. And I will be honest. The first book that I read about black people by a black person was The Color Purple, the year I graduated high school, 1983.
Wow.
And that changed everything for me. That made my dream possible again because I was, you know, thinking about doing other things. And that kind of reignited the dream that I had since I was a little girl. So
I remember the discussions about Color Purple, white people and black people. I mean, that opened up dialogue.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it did. It was
a
very
important.
A lot of people
were on the defensive too.
Well, yeah, they were. But you know, this was the reality, and my mother grew up seeing that. My grandmother grew up seeing that. So I even to this day, I don't have an issue with it. I know that the NAACP had an issue with it because it portrayed black men in such a negative light. But you know, if this is what you see and this is what you know, this is what you write.
It was written by
a black female.
A black man.
No.
You're talking about
The Color Purple?
Oh, The Color Purple. You know what I'm thinking of? I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Alex Haley.
Oh, The Roots.
Roots.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the, you know, the color. And then, you know, when the movie came out, obviously there was issue because you had this white Jewish man behind the production. But until this day, it's one of my favorite movies. It's an excellent adaptation of the book.
Of course, you know, I was enraged when it didn't get an Oscar, and the movie that got an Oscar that year was, I thought, are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's what they do to us. I mean, you know, historically, this is how it goes down, unfortunately.
Yeah, because that should have won hands down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Christie's Honor might have been okay, but it was not it was not even in that category.
Right, right.
That caliber, and it won. I was, like, shocked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was like, how could you pick one of the just the okay movies against that? That's almost like a slap in the face.
That's exactly what it was.
Indeed. Now, I want to ask you about, well, let me just ask you this. You were trying to find out or figure out what you wanted to do, and you had an interest at one time in the fashion retail business?
I did. And I know now that was only because I enjoy fashion. I like clothes. I would not call myself a fashionista, but I knew that that would allow me to travel, and that's a very big passion of mine, traveling. And so I figured, well, if I'm a merchandiser, I'll have to travel the world. And that's really the basis for that interest.
And then you did go into travel, or did you, or at least thought about it?
I did. I was in travel from, 1988 until 1997. I worked within the travel industry. And I got to see, a great portion of the world.
Wow, that's so great.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do that as a travel agent, or did you sometimes do it as a travel journalist?
No, it was always in, when I first got involved in travel was with Rock Resorts, which is a number of resorts that were owned by the Rockefeller family, I should say. And I just worked in a reservations office, and I was with them for 2 years, and then they folded, and I went to Leading Hotels of the World, and they managed hundreds of hotels around the world. And again, it was just as a reservationist. And my last job in the industry was with Sunburst Holidays, which is no longer in existence, and they were a Caribbean tour operator. And I was the customer service manager. And it was just, paperwork and letters and speaking to people. And I did take travel agents on fam trips, familiarization trips to the resorts.
Nice.
It was very nice. It was, it's a very people-oriented industry.
Indeed.
So I had a good time, I have to say.
Well, did it take courage to take the year off and write? Because a lot of people are afraid to just jump out into the ocean and swim.
I don't even know if I would use the word courage. Maybe I was frustrated knowing, I think a lot of us know what our calling is, and we may try to avoid it for whatever reason. But I was so frustrated with corporate America, and I knew that writing is what I was supposed to be doing. I knew it so well that it wasn't an issue for me to quit my job. And, the universe works in a very interesting way, because I had been working, like I said, as a customer service manager for Sunburst Holidays, and my year came up, and it was time for my increase, and they stiffed me on that. And I think that was the way the universe, used that to say, okay, you see what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
And I was pissed. And I walked into my manager's office, and I said, I'm done. I'm out. And, of course, at that point, oh, we'll give you whatever you want. No, I don't want anything. And I left.
Sounds not interesting.
I'm sorry?
It's interesting that they have it to give but won't give it.
Exactly. It's everything is a game. And so I left, and I was home for 7 months. I had, put some money aside. At the time, I was still living at home, so my rent was minimal. My expenses were minimal. And I just really focused on finishing Sugar, which I did, but I didn't sell it. And so in 1998, I had to find another job, and I ended up at Goldman Sachs. And I continued to, revise my novel and send out queries. And I think it was a year I was there for exactly a year. I think I got that job in late April, early May of 98. And April of 99 is when I received my first book deal. And I wrote my resignation letter, and the rest of is history.
That's wonderful when you can say that, that you never have to look back. But, you know, I'm going to take a little break. And since Inglorious, you went into the Renaissance, I dug up Fats Waller.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm going to play one of his songs. It's called "You're Not the Only Oyster in the Stew." And, folks, we're talking to Bernice Al McFadden, and this is Deirdre Schuler, host of Topically Yours on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow. And here we go with Fats Waller.
I'm convinced, completely, fully, firmly convinced, you're the only one for me. You're not the only wrinkle in the prune. You're not the only apple on the tree. Telling all the facts, perfectly logical, positive facts, you're the only one for me. So well supplied, the very things I see. Oh, bless you, baby. Your smile is refreshing, kisses so unique. When I'm round, I'm susceptible and weak. I love you, so to speak. There's 7 million people in New York, 50 million Frenchmen in Paris. As English, Irish, Italians, and Dutch, but you're the only one for me.
Piano, as you heard. So, I also wanted to ask you about what is the process after one writes a book? You have to promote it. How do you go about that?
Well, previously, my first publisher handled all of that. This is when I thought that I could just write my book, put it out there, go on tour, and go on to write the next book. this time around with Glorious, what I did was I just, you know, now with the social networking sites, it's a bit easier. But I contacted, you know, a lot of independent bookstores. I have a list of readers. I did a blog tour, which means I sent books to different book bloggers, and they read and reviewed the book. I held contests. That's basically it. I do a lot of Facebook, a lot of Twitter.
You have to go to all those book fairs, too?
I do some festivals. I do some, not all of them, but I do a few.
Well, as I mentioned before, you're about to release. I'm not sure if you're releasing it or it's just coming together, Gathering of Waters.
It's the first release date was February 14th, and now they've changed it to January 31st. It may change again, but right now, so we'll say early 2012.
All right, congratulations. I hope it's... Now, do you have a website where someone or people who are interested in knowing more about you and reading your book can contact
mm-hmm.
you or find out about you?
BerniceMcFadden.com. And again, I'm on Facebook, Bernice L. McFadden. And you can find me at either place.
Okay. Well, you know, our time is already up. It happened so quickly that I hope I've mentioned enough of your books. I want to mention that you've, under Geneva, you've written Heat, Seduction, Fever, and Lover Man. Now, doesn't that all sound hot and sizzling? And Sugar was one of your books, and Glorious was another, and This Bitter Earth, and several others that I don't have in front of me. But
that's okay. They can all be found on my website, BerniceMcFadden.com.
And people can get your book on Amazon as well, right?
Yes, they can. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's also available in digital form if you have a Kindle or a Nook. You can download the book.
Well, it certainly has been a pleasure having you as my guest today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences and your books with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's been my pleasure. And this is the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Souls. I'm Deirdre Shuley, your host. And as I said, we've been talking to author Bernice L. McFadden, and I encourage you to go out and buy all her books and support her because she is a fabulous writer, and I'm not just whistling Dixie, even though a lot of her characters are in the South. And that's why I'm going to end this show with Louis Armstrong singing Sleepy Time Down South. So here we go. And thank you again, Bernice, for being
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And thank my listening audience for making my topic topically yours.
Because I know that when it
sleepy time downtown. Yes, the south wind blowing through the vinewood trees. Now folks down there live a life of ease. When old mammy falls on her knees, yeah. When it's sleeping time downtown, yeah. Steamboats up the river coming and going, by the river, yeah. Bells splashing the night away, babbles of the river, oh yeah. Hear those banjos ringing, and the folks are singing, and they dance till the break of day. Yeah, dear old Southland, with this dreamy song, you take me back where I belong. Right in my mammy's arms. But that bandit bent his bones of this battle. That, but I did so that. Whoa. Good evening, everybody.